This is The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. Liverpool are good, aren't they, Barry? The sheer relentlessness from front to back. Too much for a spirited Villarreal who hold out for a half before a lucky deflection and some magic from Mo Salah to set up Sadio Mane. A tough pod then in our search for more superlatives. For Klopp's men, they must be just so hard to play against. Fitness, pace, power and Thiago. Also today, the sad demise of Oldham Athletic, the first side ever to have been in the Premier League and subsequently drop out of the Football League. What's gone wrong and will this be the next club that disappears without a trace? We'll look ahead to the Europa League. For those who listened before this evening, there's an Enkelman level own goal at the top of Serie A to the AOB we didn't have time for yesterday. Your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Barry Glendenning, welcome.
Hi, Max.
Hello, Mark Langdon.
Hello, Max.
Hello, Lars Sivertsen.
Good morning, Max.
And hello, Sid Lowe.
Morning, Max.
Let's start at Anfield, shall we? Liverpool 2, Villarreal 0. After the City-Real Madrid game, this is always going to be... It was unlikely to be anything but an anti-climax. I thought Villarreal did okay last, but the relentlessness, as I said at the opening of Liverpool, is ridiculous, isn't it? They must be impossible to play against because you get the ball for like a second and then they're on you straight away.
Yeah, they did okay in the sense of the defensive phase of the game, I thought. I mean, at the end of the day, if you go away to Liverpool and you come away and you've conceded a deflected cross and a goal that was an inch away from being offside, like that's not a disastrous defensive performance, I don't think. But the big difference between this and other sort of Villarreal genius performances in the Champions League, I thought, was that they just weren't able to get at them on the counter at all. Because Liverpool don't have... Well, first of all, they're a much better football team than Juventus at almost everything. But comparing to Bayern Munich, for instance, Bayern Munich have these sort of glaring weaknesses defensively on the flanks because they play with a back three and then just two outright wingers at wing back. So you can get in that there's always a space to exploit there. But with Liverpool, they weren't able to get out when they won possession. Now they weren't always. I think that's why there's been quite a lot of criticism of their style, Villarreal, is that they don't always like try to hit you on the break immediate. They do try to play a couple of passes to take the sting out of things, to take the tempo down a little bit, and that can look a bit miserable. But generally, they do actually try to build counterattacks. But they weren't able to do it. Fabinho was really good, and Liverpool have gotten so good at mitigating the risks of playing with a high line by being really good at stopping counters. And they just strangled Villarreal, and they weren't able to create anything on the counter. And I think that's why the game ended up being a tough watch, put it that way.
Mark, we don't talk about fitness a lot, mainly because it's not very interesting, is it? I'm not about to say, you know, what do you bench? I'm not going down that line, Mark.
But not much, Max.
But like, it is important. I mean, it sounds really stupid to say, but the fitness of Liverpool is just, it's extraordinary.
It is, yeah. And I think that has now become really, you know, part of the issue that teams are actually now sort of scared of trying to play through Liverpool and because they feel like they can't. And so, you know, the way that they box you in, I always think when Henderson plays, even though he's, you know, maybe not as gifted maybe as Naby Keita, I think Henderson is somebody really that sets the tone for that pressing. Luis Diaz feels like he was made for Liverpool, the way that he's come in and just been able to pick up that press as well has been fantastic to see. Mane now playing through the middle, maybe even more dangerous than when he was on the wing. And there's another one that, you know, he's probably as good at the kind of counter pressing as anyone else really in that Liverpool team. And I also think the bravery of Klopp, because he, as Lars was saying there, you know, he plays his defenders on the halfway line. And that is a scary prospect for a lot of teams, but it enables them to be, so good on the press because they're only pressing in sort of smaller areas. I remember sort of Pochettino talking about pressing when he first came to sort of England, maybe even with Southampton, where he was saying, we're not running sort of harder and faster than other people. We're doing it in a smarter way. And I feel that Liverpool are very smart in the way that they sort of press the opponents. It's not just the fact that they're really fit. I think that the the tactical scheme from Klopp and his coaches enables them to do that and maybe look fitter even than they are.
Before we came on air, Sid, you were saying you thought Villarreal were a disgrace.
Yes.
Sorry, Sid. You weren't saying, for the tape, you weren't saying that.
Let me just throw this out there. Well, you know, this was slightly part of the off-air talk, but let's throw it in on air. It is remarkable how in a world in which when journalists speak out of turn about footballers, there's lots of talk about respect and not understanding the game. And no one is more dismissive, more nasty, and more excitable, shall we say, about footballers than footballers themselves. It's really quite extraordinary. Anyway, that's by the by. Just to pick up on something Mark said there, that idea about Pochettino saying we're not necessarily running any harder than other people, we're just running smarter. This was always the big thing that Guardiola would say, and that came a bit from Cruyff as well, that idea that if you squeeze the play right at the top of the pitch, it looks like you're more intense, it looks like you're more physical, but it's that you're running 20 metres rather than 80. You're making the pitch smaller, obviously with the risk that the ball goes over the back of you. And this was the famous line from Tito Villanova, who of course was Guardiola's assistant coach and became Barcelona's coach, about how this his actual words were, this whole invention falls apart without Gerard Piqué, because you need that defender that knows how to manage that line high and play with it. One of the things I was struck by last night a lot with Liverpool was how many times they won possession running back towards their own goal. So Villarreal would get through that first little line, but then there'd be this almost this pantomime-y, he's behind you thing, and then someone would come sprinting back and take it off them again, where they kind of thought they were through and they were away, and then the tackle comes in from behind them. In terms of Villarreal, Unai Emery said something I thought really quite interesting yesterday. You know, we talk about what Villarreal did and what Villarreal tried to do, and they're not necessarily the same thing. And I think that's one of the things we sometimes forget when we talk about games. We talk about games sometimes as if what we saw was exactly what was in the plan for both teams. And of course, two teams are playing. You can only do sometimes what the other team allows you to do, and Liverpool don't allow you to do very much. And Emery said that there were kind of three elements to what they were trying to do that they couldn't do. He said, we couldn't win. So we couldn't really get control of the ball for any real amount of time. And so that was obviously part of it, to get the ball down. And Lars was talking about, you know, take the pace out of it, hold possession for a little bit. Even if you're not going anywhere, just kind of, you know, bring everything down to the level that you want it at in terms of the speed of the game. And he said, and we weren't able to run either. And obviously that idea that you release someone and they run onto it. Obviously, without Gerard Moreno, it's different. He is genuinely a brilliant footballer. And without him, it makes a huge difference. He said, so you get these three things we're trying to do. He said, and we couldn't. And so he says, the only thing that's really left at that point is to resist. And he said, we more or less did that. Not very well. And he wasn't happy with how they played. But I think that's one of the things that is worth pointing out here. And in particular, before you start going on about how a team is a disgrace, because a team does at times what it's able to. And against a team like Liverpool, in this kind of environment, at least, what you're able to do is actually quite limited.
Michael Owen and Peter Crouch are on telly saying, look, this is the best Liverpool side they've ever seen. I don't know if that's recency bias. I'm loath to ask you to find some more superlatives, right? It's difficult, but like, this is such a... And that, I don't know what their best front three is, right? It feels like it's Mane, Salah and one of the others. But that midfield three of Henderson, Fabinho and Thiago is sort of perfectly balanced, isn't it?
Yeah, you'd have to say it is probably the best Liverpool team of all time. And there will be people who argue that the Liverpool team of the 80s, which I really enjoyed watching, were better. But they were playing a completely different sport. You know, that's the team with Dalglish, Rush, Souness, Phil Thompson, Michael Robinson, Sid's old pal, and, you know, people like that, Bruce Grobbelaar in goal. I don't think you're comparing apples and oranges if you're trying to figure out which team is better. This Liverpool team, if they took on that Liverpool team in the pump, would absolutely obliterate them, you know, because the advances in sports science, diet, players looking after themselves better, levels of fitness are just off the scale. I think it's probably fair. I don't think we'll get in trouble, Max. Just to say that the person who said Villarreal was a disgrace, for people who may not be aware, was Jason Cundy on TalkSport. I disagree with them completely, but yeah, the BT Sport pundits were purring about Liverpool after the game. They do tend to be ludicrously biased in favour of English teams or British teams, but I think it's a fair assessment. I'd just argue Villarreal could arguably have done better, but when you look at their side, the six players in their starting lineup who couldn't really hack it in the Premier League, you know, Juan Foyt, Estupiñán, Capoue, Coquelin, Lo Celso and Danjuma. So they couldn't hack it at top-ish end to lower-end Premier League teams. They're now at Villarreal and they're in the Champions League semi-final and they're not completely out of it after one leg. So against one of the best teams in the world, one of the best teams that's ever played football. So I think it's rather harsh to be so disparaging of their efforts.
I don't know when is the right time to sort of talk about Jurgen Klopp's legacy and what he's built. And we all knew he was good, but actually quite what he's achieved. And I think like Craig Foster on telly was saying, like actually net spend is like 14th in Europe, you know, sort of behind Aston Villa, for example. Like actually what he's done is miraculous.
Yeah, it really is. It's easy to forget that when he took over, there was a sense that Liverpool could be left behind by the other sort of top four teams. I mean, they were, if I recall, I think they had something like the fifth highest turnover. So in financial terms, they were sort of slightly being, you know, behind the very top teams. I think I wrote at the time, it's a while ago now, but I think I wrote something about how the Liverpool job is maybe the most difficult managerial job in the world, because you're taking over a club who, because of the club's stature and legacy and fan base, you know, they rightfully expect to be near the top. But financially, they're quite far off the very top teams. And then finding a way to compete is incredibly difficult. Now, part of why they've gotten so as far as they have is that they've bought and sold very cleverly. And that's to do with more than Jurgen Klopp. But it's also clear that, you know, without Jurgen Klopp, none of this happens. And he's done an absolutely extraordinary job. And I think him going into Liverpool and harnessing the sort of emotional energy of Liverpool, the city and Anfield and the Cup and everything, and turning them into a sort of an English Dortmund. Yeah, I could have seen that happen. But that's not what they are now. They've morphed into something more. And I think if we talk about how extraordinary this team is, and we do run out of superlatives, but I'm really struck by how they've gotten so much better at mastering a game like this, when it actually does become again about being a little bit patient, about controlling things. You know, a lot of people said Thiago wouldn't fit in when he went there. I mean, part of what he does is give them a little bit of something different in midfield.
That's exactly what they wanted, by the way. I mean, when the move to Thiago was designed precisely to address the possibility that, look, we play this way, teams work it out, we need to have another. And if the plan B, I mean, it's not obviously as simple as having a plan A and a plan B, but if the plan B debilitates plan A a tiny bit, fine, because it needs to have more variety. This was, I don't know whether you saw it, but the pre-match press conference that Unai Emery gave really addressed this really, it was really quite interesting, Unai Emery, because he was saying, look, obviously, his Sevilla team beat Klopp's Liverpool at the end of Klopp's first season in the Europa League final. And he said, of course, he played against them with Arsenal. He said he was at the Champions League final in Madrid when they played Spurs. And he said, that was a magnificent team. He said, but he described this team as updated and improved. And he said, and this is a team that's coming inside more, that's opening the pitch out with the fullbacks, but not so that they can go up the wing, but to create the space for the guys inside to play. He said, we're seeing much more combination between the lines. We're seeing much more subtlety. We're seeing Luis Diaz come inside, Sadio Mane play inside. And essentially, obviously, it boils down to Thiago, but it's not quite that simple. But he was really interesting, Unai Emery, in terms of analysing the idea. Because the question in the press conference was very direct. The question was, don't you think that the easiest way to stop Liverpool is to play very, very defensive? And he said, well, it might have been, because they used to be runners. But they're so much more than runners now. And I thought it was obviously, it's Unai Emery. He should be able to give us an analysis. But I thought it was interesting just to kind of break from this idea of Liverpool as being this team that plays everything at breakneck speed, because they've got that extra little thing as well, which, of course, Thiago is so central to. But that was exactly the plan when they went for him.
And actually, what's interesting, Mark, isn't it, is that in our minds, or maybe just my mind, you know, Man City are the metronomic control games, aren't vulnerable. Liverpool, the reason that the sort of neutrals find them slightly more exciting is there is this vulnerability about Liverpool. And, you know, City have the depth and Liverpool don't. But actually, Liverpool have suddenly got the deepest squad sort of by stealth, like it just sort of happened, you know, like not like in a blink of an eye. And actually they do now have this control. Like, yes, they just controlled everything.
Yeah, and I think actually with the way that you try to stop Manchester City now, a lot of teams will give Man City the wings and then, you know, look to head the crosses away. And I think that that's really dangerous against Liverpool, because we've seen actually that, you know, all of their players actually are probably better in the air than maybe those Manchester City ones. So they can score off crosses, and Alexander-Arnold will quite often, you know, put in delicious balls, or, you know, Salah can as well. So I do think that they've got a little bit more to their game in that respect. I think the squad depth comes down to the fact that their recruitment has just been so spot on. It's hard to think of, you know, too many sort of wasted millions, really. And with Manchester City, you could argue maybe, I mean, I think it's a bit harsh, but, you know, City spent 100 million on Grealish, and, you know, they're going, well, what does he do different to what they kind of already had? And they've obviously got sort of some other issues with off-field players, you know, as well at the moment. So I think that Liverpool's recruitment has been absolutely outstanding, and that has enabled them to get this sort of depth of squad now that, and, you know, means they can bring on Naby Keita and Jota, and, you know, just gives them different options. So I think as well as Klopp has done, and he has been fantastic, whoever is involved in the recruitment, and I suspect it's a very much a team effort, you know, just got that part of it absolutely nailed.
And yet, Barry, they could just win the Carabao Cup, this greatest Liverpool team of all time. You know, they've got this month of madness now.
Well, they were kept saying on BT Sport that they're on the verge of winning the quadruple.
Verge doing a lot of heavy lifting in that sentence.
Yeah, I'm not sure what actually constitutes a verge, but it is. Yeah, it's conceivable they could only win the Carabao Cup, in which case the season would be crushingly disappointing for them.
In many ways, you'd call Klopp a disgrace for
possibly. Yeah, I mean, we're naughty here, slagging our peers. I mean, we say plenty of daft things
as opinions,
well,
Clive, isn't it?
I have to say, it would be quite funny if they only won the Carabao Cup.
But I mean, this is, we do try to resist the urge towards hyperbole and stuff like that. But it is looking a little bit like, there was a period a few years back when Messi and Ronaldo were at their best, and you looked at Real Madrid and Barcelona, and they were clearly the two best teams in the world. And all the sort of the Premier League is the best team in the league in the world stuff was clearly a bit nonsensical. But really, I don't think there's much of a discussion that Liverpool and Man City are the two best teams in the world right now. So I think as much as it's possible for Liverpool to end up, you know, they are on a giant verge, and the outcome on one side of the verge could be the quadruple, and the outcome of the other verge could be the sort of the Carabao Cup. I don't know what the word for that is, the Juan de Ramos season.
They could get a Carabao Cup and Everton relegated. That would be a decent double.
It would be.
Jake says, how much does Raul Albiol look like he's starring in The Lighthouse? He's got fashionably grizzled down to a fine art. Yeah, is that Willem Dafoe in The Lighthouse? We could just put Albiol next to whichever two grizzled Hollywood stars were in it, and the film would be very similar. This is from Simon, says, Tuesday saw light blue v dark blue. Wednesday, I presume, be red v yellow. What are the Potter's favourite football colour clashes? Classic red v blue, white v stripy. It's very hard to look past Brazil, Italy, isn't it?
Yeah.
For just, I'm watching a football match, and, you know, perhaps in 1982, I don't know, but like, just that, they are the colours that I go, this is, I'm looking forward to this. I don't know if anyone has an advance on Brazil, Italy.
I'll go the Spurs sort of mauve kit versus the old Sheffield United brown one.
That Chelsea brown and orange. Remember the Chelsea brown and orange? That was magnificent.
The Coventry had a brown as well, didn't they? Okay.
I think it's Coventry. I may have did Sheffield United a service there.
Do you know how Barry really doesn't like the cul-de-sac questions? Yeah. Like, I'm like that, but with all the sartorial sort of kit aesthetics and boot stuff. I've got nothing. Okay, that and music.
Fine. Just say Puma Kings every time. Mark, you sent in the WhatsApp group. Martin Ziegler's in a report in the Times about UEFA's plan for, quote, a week of football, which feels like most weeks to me. I must say, but what's different about this one?
You should try going outside. And just sort of...
So the idea from UEFA is to get rid of the Champions League semi-final two legs, according to this report anyway, and to have it a bit like a World Cup, or like we did during the pandemic, where they moved the final four to one city, play a semi-finals on a Tuesday, Wednesday, and then play the final on a Saturday or Sunday. As a TV viewer, I mean, I think that would be quite exciting. But I also can sort of see why, as a supporter, you'd be very angry, because, you know, you're asking maybe four sets of supporters, but probably at least a couple to go and sort of decamp to a city. And, you know, you're not getting even your one game of a semi-final. You saw Anfield, you know, packed to the rafters, and the Etihad the night before. I mean, how many of them would, A, get tickets, B, be able to afford to go and, you know, to Lisbon for a week or whatever it is? So.
You'd have to, like, find, like a set of fans from the other semi-finalist, and you'd say, look, we'll both book the hotel for the rest of the week, and whoever wins keeps it, and you give me half the money or something. That's quite impractical.
And another issue, I think, was obviously it did work to an extent during the pandemic, but there were no fans there. Can you imagine? I think it's different with country supporters. Could you imagine four sets of club supporters in one city? I think that would bring potential trouble. I mean, there was a game in the Europa League, wasn't there, when
Eintracht Frankfurt and West Ham in Seville, yeah,
they're both in Seville on a Wednesday and a Thursday, and then there are issues. I mean, you know, you'd hope that everybody could behave like, you know, grown up.
You're a dreamer, Mark. You're a dreamer, Mark, aren't you?
You know, that's not going to happen. So I think that there are. It feels to me like there are more negatives than positives behind this potential move.
Also, there's a very basic thing, isn't there? It seems to me that there just seems to be this desperation at the moment to piss about with things. Like this is basically all right. There's nothing really wrong with this. Why are we so determined all the time to piss about with formats and to save football from itself? Football only needs saving from the people who are trying to save it. It doesn't make any sense.
I want to ask you before we let you go about, you mentioned Gerard Piqué being very good at, you know, managing a defensive line, Sid. How good is he at making buckets of money out of moving the Spanish Super Cup?
Very, very good indeed. I it's very difficult to know exactly where to start with this, Max. Shall I try and start with the basics? And if you want to kind of expand from there, the basics are that a series of recordings have been found and published by, I say found, obviously found is a very nebulous word. They've almost certainly been stolen and sold and published by El Confidencial, which is an online media here in Spain. And essentially it's a series of WhatsApp voice notes. As you know, Max, because I do this to you, voice noting is a very Spanish thing on WhatsApp. What a series of WhatsApp voice notes between Gerard Piqué and Rubiales, the president of the Spanish Football Federation, which reveal a whole series of things. But the starting point for this was the first message that was kind of turned into a story was that Piqué's role in, and this is again is a bit like that idea of the Final Four, in taking the Spanish Super Cup, repackaging it as a four-team tournament, taking it to Saudi Arabia, and the structure of that competition, and also the payments made to the clubs to pay in that competition, basically shows a very, very close relationship between Piqué and the president of the federation. Piqué essentially as his business partner, as the man who made all this happen. Now, up to a point, this wasn't entirely news, because we knew that Piqué's company had been involved in taking the Spanish Super Cup to Saudi Arabia. The thing is, of course, when you hear it in audios and you hear the kind of the very matey tone and the friendliness between them, that then poses all sorts of other questions about things like a conflict of interest and so on. And then other recordings have come out since, which have suggested that this goes a little bit beyond just the Super Cup itself. Piqué and the Federation have consistently said, you know, there's nothing illegal in this. The question, I suppose, is at what point does the barrier get crossed in terms of interest? Because this is Piqué effectively being the guy that set up a competition he's still playing in. And so that has difficulties there. My favourite line in this, I don't know if you heard this, was the president of the Federation saying, this is mafia behaviour, you know, the stealing of the recordings and the publishing of the recordings. He said, now, I'm not saying you're going to find me in a ditch with a gunshot wound in the back of my head, but I can't promise that they won't find a bag of cocaine in the back of my car. And everyone said, is this, you know, putting your excuses in just in case?
So hang on. This is like... I'm Eric Laporte, moving the FA Cup final to, I don't know, wherever he wants to Thailand.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, so imagine this, exactly. Imagine this was Eric Laporte. Well, I mean, it's got to be someone sort of us.
Harry captain. Maguire.
Imagine this is Jordan Henderson.
Let's make it Harry Maguire because he's always, you know, it's
Harry Maguire. Him. Harry Maguire. Yeah.
I was just wondering who you would choose as your shifty player here. Okay, right. So this is Harry Maguire going to the FA and saying, you know that Charity Shield? It's a bit rubbish, isn't it? Let's take the Charity Shield to Saudi Arabia, make it a four-team competition. I can make it happen. I'll organise it for you. Harry Maguire's company gets €8 million for doing this. The competition goes there. And here's one of the focal points of this. We've got to get four teams to go. Yeah, but Liverpool and City really don't want to. Oh, well, we'll give them $8 million each. And how much are we giving Man United and Chelsea for going with them? Now, they can have $1 million. Who cares about them? So long as we get Liverpool and City there. Well, obviously, I know in Spain, it's bigger, the divide between Madrid and Barcelona and everyone else. Than
Harry Maguire's done his own club out of money there. He's not thought this through, Harry.
Obviously, PK, this is why Maguire wasn't the right example. This is why we had to say Henderson.
Well, if Harry Maguire was doing it, we'd have five teams and they'd end up playing on the Isle of Wight.
Yeah, and they'd accidentally bump into each other en route and turn up late. But anyway, so you've got this thing where, exactly, so you've got a player effectively saying to the Federation, look, if Valencia only make 800 grand for going, just so long as we've got Madrid and Barcelona there.
Right.
And of course, the rules have been shifted to get Madrid and Barcelona there because, of course, that's economically viable. And then you get the other two or three things that should be thrown into the mix here, and I realise it's now getting a bit more complex. Imagine on top of that, Harry Maguire also owned a club in the third tier of English football.
Sunderland.
We've had worse owners.
So the president of the Federation... That is very true. The president of the Federation, who is your business partner, is the ultimate arbiter of the sport that you play and the sport that the club you own is playing in. And there are some recordings, for example, of PK effectively saying, it would be quite nice if my team got an easier division.
Oh, right, okay. Anyway, let me just say that Gerard Piqué took to Twitch to say, everything we have done is legal. I'm going to expose my part in the conflict of interest. I want to show my face because I have nothing to hide. I'm proud of what we do at Cosmos, which is his company. We wanted to change the format of the competition and make it more interesting for the viewer. That had repercussions on income. The president, Luis Rubiales, really liked the idea. Sid, you can go away now.
Thank you.
Sid Lowe.
Cheerio.
Out in Spain. And we'll be back in a second. We look ahead to the Europa League and do some Serie A too. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Liam says, will I be kicked out of the live show if I shine laser pens at Barry when he's posed a question? Absolutely not. If you buy a ticket, you can bring as many laser pens as you want. Myticket.co.uk. We're on the road in June, July. 13th of June in Leeds, 15th in Birmingham, 19th in Manchester, 5th of July in Dublin, sold out. So we're doing the 4th of July in Dublin now as well. Tickets selling very fast. We're very popular in Ireland, Barry, for some reason. Don't be smug about it. Hackney Empire, 8th and 9th of July, Glasgow on the 13th. All the lineups will be announced soon. Before we look ahead to tonight's games, Nicky was talking about Inter's game in hand yesterday, and Lars, it didn't quite work out for them, did it?
It really didn't. It started pretty well. Ivan Perisic scored just really an amazing goal, like a great hit. Perisic is having a really good season. One of these things, like Ivan Perisic wing back, is one of those concepts that I would have kind of looked, you know, laughed about. But he's been very good, and he scored a really, really good hit. And then we got the equaliser from Marko Arnautovic, who has really found his niche, I think. I mean, I've always wondered, Marko Arnautovic, you know, what are you for? You know, you're clearly too talented to be rubbish, but too rubbish to be good. Turns out, being the mercurial striker of a mid-table Serie A team is like what he should have been doing all along. It's just completely perfect for him. So he's having a good season for Bologna. So it was 1-1, and the game was kind of... Inter were massively dominant, creating loads of chances. But right towards the end, their reserve goalkeeper, Ionut Radu from Romania, who was in goal instead of Handanovic, is simply going to control a throw-in, which he does not control at all, and he does the full ankleman and sort of tries to kick it away, almost falls over, and then it dribbles back into the goal. It's a really, really awful, awful moment for them.
And that means Milan 74 points, Inter 2 points behind. Both teams played 34. Ian says, why are you jinxing West Ham's Europa League run by having an extra on Friday? You were doing a pod tomorrow after the Europa League games and the conference. Can't you just roll over any comments until part three on Monday as an afterthought, as usual? It's brought us this far. Otherwise, keep up the good work. Come on, you Irons. What a big night for West Ham, Mark.
Absolutely, yeah. You know, it's been a great run for them. I felt like maybe Sevilla would have been the end, but actually they dealt with that really well. Against Lyon, you know, when they were down to 10 men at the end of that first half, again, really battled hard and, you know, and deserved to go through in the end. On paper, at least, this feels like a slightly easier game when you see that Eintracht Frankfurt are, you know, mid-table in the Bundesliga, quite an inconsistent team. But I was really impressed with the way that they beat Barcelona. Both games, particularly the first one, actually. I know the second game at Camp Nou kind of grabbed all the headlines, but I felt that they really pushed Barcelona in the first match. So, you know, West Ham just need to be careful of not being too confident. It didn't sound like that supporter was overly confident, but, you know, it's a big opportunity for them. One player to watch out for, I think, as far as sort of dealing with that Frankfurt threat is Kostic, the left wing back that's, you know, he plays very attacking, you know, as a left wing back and set pieces and stuff like that. So he's a big danger. But, you know, West Ham at semi-final stage of Europa League, you probably couldn't ask for much more than this game, I wouldn't have thought. And in fairness, Frankfurt will be thinking the same as well, you know, not playing one of the real sort of big headline acts that started out in this competition, or certainly in the, you know, after Christmas, when you've seen the likes of Dortmund and Barcelona eliminated. So really is up for grabs.
And Rangers go to Leipzig, Lars. What's the current state of play with RB Leipzig?
Unfortunately for Rangers, they're very good. They've kind of gotten their stuff together. I mean, they lost to Union at the weekend, having said that. But after changing the coach to Tedesco before Christmas, I guess it was, they really sort of firmed up the defense. I mean, last time I checked, they had the second highest points total since the turn of the year. I can double check that again, but basically they're very good, probably the second best team in the Bundesliga right now, and they're not as defensively frail as they were under Jesse Marsch. They're a better team than Dortmund, I'd say. They're certainly not as fragile defensively as Dortmund. They shouldn't be anyway. And this is a huge, huge task for Rangers. But, you know, Rangers have surprised us before in this tournament. So I'd be foolish to write them off.
In the Conference League, Baz, Leicester versus Roma. Are you looking forward to Jose back on these shores?
Not especially. I've paid barely any attention to the Europa Conference League, or indeed the Europa League up until this point. I'll probably watch the West Ham game tonight. So if they get to the final, grand.
As is your wont.
Well, that's the same attitude that Brendan Rodgers had to the competition when Leicester were parachuted into, when he said, "What is it?" You know.
To be fair, at least I know what it is, and that's why I don't really care about it. I don't think when the Europa Conference League was dreamt up by UEFA officials, teams like Leicester and Roma doing well in it was quite what they had in mind. Maybe it was, but I would rather see a team like, I don't know, Shamrock Rovers or AFC Vilnius or whoever in you know, progressing in that competition.
Also tonight, Manchester United played Chelsea in a game that it seems a really kind of, it's the most meh Manchester United-Chelsea that I can remember in quite a long time.
It's quite funny, Max, actually, because I went to write down the weekend fixtures, and this sort of is a bit of a throwback for your week of football jape or joke. I went to write down the weekend fixtures and pick out any eye catchers, and then I realised, oh, Man U were playing Chelsea tonight. I didn't even know that was on tonight.
Yeah, Man United have a lot of injury problems. Harry Maguire has a knee injury. He's also trying to move the Community Shield, so he's busy. He's busy
moving it to
that.
Malta for some reason. It makes no sense.
Yeah, Jadon Sancho has tonsillitis. Fred, Luke Shaw, Pogba, Cavani, all out. Wan-Bissaka's a doubt. Lars, you wanted to say something?
I mean, I'm not sure I fully agree that it's a meh game. I'm kind of looking forward to it. I think United being just a pile of hot garbage will never really get boring, I think. But there's still so much individual talent that they could play well, you know, and you never really know. Whereas with Chelsea, of course, there have been a few sort of gremlins in the machine recently. If that's they haven't quite been going to plan, and we don't really know what's happening over the summer. But they still also have very good players. I think this could be a fun game. I mean, certainly United not really looking convincing at the back, but looking all right-ish going forward against Arsenal. I mean, if we have more of that, it could be fun.
Could be. We'll find out. We'll talk about it tomorrow. And that'll do for part two. In part three, Mike Keegan, author, journalist, and Oldham Athletic fan, will join us to talk about the demise of the Latics. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Richard writes, can you spend some time on the plight of Oldham Athletic? I'm not a supporter, but I feel it needs to be covered and not just glossed over. Let's bring an expert on this, Mike Keegan, author, journalist with The Mail, Oldham Athletic fan. How you doing, Mike?
Yeah, not great. Thanks, Max. How are you?
yeah, better, actually. Safe in League One. You wrote this book, This Is How It Feels, An English Football Miracle, which is, you know, about that Oldham side that, you know, older, you know, listeners of our age will remember, you know, Joe Royal, the plastic pitch, Andy Ritchie and Frankie Bunn and Dennis Irwin and stuff. And, it, you know, tell us firstly a bit about the book and then we'll get on to the demise in a sec.
So, yeah, that's it, really. I don't think, as an Oldham fan, I'm 43 now, so I was like 11 when all this kicked off. And I don't think the story had actually been told properly. So, you know, the stuff out there that's your blow by blow, then we beat them and then we drew with them. But I used to cover Oldham for the Manchester Evening News, one of the first jobs that I did. Gordon Lawton, who was like a legend at the club, who worked in the office there, said, you need to write this book because some of the stuff that went on off the pitch that has never been reported was as good as what went on the pitch. So the best thing was everyone that I spoke to was like going, basically pushing on an open door. So I turned up at Joe Earl's house and I ended up going there six times for hours on end. Ian Marshall I met at the Hilton in Leicester and had a nice lunch with him. And everyone was just delighted to give me their time, really. For me, these were like my heroes. So this was the greatest days of my life, as sad as that sounds. And I hope I've done it justice. There's a lot of stuff in there about the shenanigans. There's an incident in Magaluf where they all ended up in a Spanish prison for a while. An incident with Bobby Ball of Cannon and Ball fame where he stormed off in a huff after they were taking the mick out of him and various stuff like that. But above all, it's a story of intelligence, really. So Joe Royal, as a player, as daft as it sounds, given he was playing for Everton in England, subsidised his wages by buying and selling used cars. And he was able to kind of transfer those skills, that eye for a bargain, to footballers. And he was assisted by a chairman who, Ian Stott, great character, entrepreneur. He had caravan parks. He had Jaguar garages. He owned a nightclub in Cheshire where he used to drink champagne with George Best. And they kind of teamed up to outwit people with much bigger budgets than they had. And they loved it. And it's just, it's the total opposite of what we have now. It's a book about intelligence. And what we have now is sadly the other extreme.
You know, until I was listening to people talk about this and you know, supporting a lower league club, right, you know, in most of the time it's shit, but like occasionally it's okay, right? You like you know, Cambridge got promoted last year and we're safe in League One. We may go, who knows? You go down a lot, you don't go up that often. But hearing that Oldham, since that relegation from the Premier League, have never got promoted, have never got to a playoff final. It has just been kind of like, and like for you at 11, you know, it's the same as me as a Cambridge fan in 1990, right? You know, watching us go up, and you don't realize that football isn't always this easy and this fun. That you've basically, since that time, it's been a disaster, right?
Yeah. And it is exactly that. So when I'm that age, I'm thinking, this is great. We've beaten Arsenal there, top of the league. You know, I think Lothar Matthäus was the big player at the time. We'll get in Europe and I'll see Lothar Matthäus on the plastic pitch and we'll see how good he is at Boundary Park. And you don't realise that, you know, it's cruel, really. This is as good as it will ever get in your lifetime. And yeah, our standards now, our bar is set incredibly low because we've had 21 years in League One, which at the time we were like, this is soul destroying. We, you know, we've gone from playing United and City and we've got Hartlepool coming here and doing us 2-0. And it's, you think that's bad. And then you look at where we are now, we would kill to be back in League One. But I don't think, and obviously I'm biased, I don't think there's another club whose fan base has had it as miserable as that. Yes, there's clubs that have gone out of the league, but they've had promotions, they've had comebacks, they've had, you know, seasons that they've enjoyed. I couldn't remember the last season that I enjoyed.
And a testament to the fans who like still go, right? So tell us the situation now. Obviously, the fans are not happy with the owners. It's been all sorts of things happening. The main fear for me is like I'm worried that there'll be another Macclesfield Bury type situation. Explain what the situation is with the current owner.
So that's totally it. And the sad thing is people are thinking this is the darkest day in the club's history, and it is. But I think personally that there is a lot worse to come. In a year's time, I would be surprised, A, if we're still here, and B, if we're not in Conference North. The problem we've got, so historically, the previous owners, they still own the stadium and the land. So all the current guy owns is the badge and a business that doesn't make any money.
Who is this guy, Mike? Sorry.
So he's called Abdallah Lemsigan. He is a Moroccan, Dubai-based former agent. None of us could ever figure out why he got involved. The biggest problem, he put his brother, Mohammed, in as sporting director early on. He should be nowhere near a park team. So almost immediately when the takeover happened, John Sheridan was the manager at the time. Seriously, busloads of often overseas trialists turned up for training, the vast majority of whom were just nowhere near good enough. There's been this incredible churn. I think the aim was to bring in players from the lower divisions of France, put them in the shop window, and then sell them on for a profit. Of every single player they've signed in 4 years and more, they've not done that once. And now you've got to think with Brexit, that goes out of the window because you're not going to get work permits for these people. So I don't get it. None of us get it why they're there. To be fair, when he first came in, you know, he signed a guy on loan, a Dutch winger, Queensy May. They're paying him 12 grand a week in League One at Oldham. And it's crazy. And the sad thing is, if that level of investment is correct, we should be in the Championship now. But because it's such a car crash, we are where we are.
I was listening. So at the last game, there was a protest, right? And then the game was stopped. And then all the fans left. They tried to finish it behind closed doors. And what I heard was from a supporters bar, you could see the pitch, and the owners made stewards put advertising hoardings, like lift them up, so fans couldn't see the last few minutes of the game. I mean, that is just like, it's insanity, right?
Yeah.
You cannot... I mean, I don't need to tell you, I don't need to tell anyone listening, but like, how can you run a club and not try and have a positive relationship with your fans?
Yeah, it's like the darkest comedy you could imagine. The stewards actually had to press the backsides against the advertisement hoardings to keep them in place.
Oh, no.
I feel so sorry for the fans because despite everything that's happened, when John Sheridan came back in as kind of a last resort, there was a truce called, and the attendances, incredible for where we are. So, you know, we played Bradford, Rochdale, teams like that, and we were getting 8,500, 9,000 in. You know, there's more than 6,000 home fans clicking through the turnstiles for a team that's bottom of League Two. They played at Stevenage and they sold out the away end at Stevenage, like 1,400 down there, 1,500 at Port Vale the other week. And then the atmosphere has actually been really good. There's a group of kids who go there, the Atleticos, who have the Tifos, and really create a great atmosphere. But what they don't seem to understand is that this is like a one-time deal only. The guy said he was selling the club, so we will take him, despite all the false promises and lies that have been previously, we'll take him at his word. He's brought back John Sheridan, who's a legend at the club. We'll get behind this. As soon as it becomes clear that this sale looks like a mirage and that we get relegated, that's gone. So everybody went onto the pitch. You can't really condone it. It would have been better if it was at the final whistle. We're going to go down anyway. I think the plan for the Tranmere game on Saturday is for everybody to dress in black. I don't even know if our last game in the EFL for, you know, I don't know if we'll ever be back. I bought a half-season ticket myself as part of this show of goodwill when Sheridan came back. I would imagine the Crawley game, there's a decent chance of it being played behind closed doors. So I think the fans have got to be praised for kind of keeping up their side of the bargain, but it will be carnage from now on while that man remains in charge of the football club.
Yeah, we had a message from Jim Booth. You probably know him, board director of the Oldham Athletic Supporters Foundation, saying, look, they're looking for good people with the club and fans at heart to be part of a consortium to purchase the club. We have a plan and some investment. We need more people on board to make it happen. Could you let people know so they can contact us, please? Which is, that's fine, but that showed you the level of desperation, right? It's not really how you get people to buy Oldham Athletic. You know, I totally understand what, you know, why you'd be asking anyone anywhere, but like, it seems such a, like the really depressing thing, right? It would be funny if it wasn't so depressing, right? And it is a sign, and I think this happens every time, and I don't know if you agree, Mark, and I don't know how you felt when Macclesfield and Bury went. I still think, I'm talking to you about Oldham Athletic, and I'm not really doing the joining the dots and going, this could be my club, because I'm thinking, okay, it's not, you know, we're fine, we're well run, it's fine. But it could be anyone's club, couldn't it?
Yeah, exactly that. And Martin Samuel did a piece in our paper about the regulator, and you know, people have their own thoughts on that. But I struggle to see a time where you can bring in a fit and proper person's test that tests people for stupidity. And you can't, you know, if these people have got the money and it comes from the right places and they tick all the boxes, you can't stop somebody taking over a club because you're worried it will be an absolute basket case under their control. So yeah, it could. It could quite easily be somebody else. With the Bury thing, I've got friends who are Bury fans. With the Mac thing, we aren't, things are that bad. We are looking at Macclesfield certainly in the setup they've got there now with envy. You know, the fact things are that bad that fans would take another three relegations, so we're playing our local you know, village teams, just so long as we can get rid of this guy. That's how bad things are. And there is, at this moment in time, nothing to stop another Abdallah Lemsigan from buying another club in League One and doing exactly the same thing.
And is there any contact with him? Is there any sort of negotiating? Is there any way of saying, look, you know, this is a community? Like, I don't know Oldham at all, right? But I imagine the football club is a really big community asset in not like an amazingly rich town, right?
Yeah, exactly that. And we don't. What doesn't help is you can get in your car at Boundary Park and within 20 minutes you're at the Etihad. You know, it's bad enough having City and United on your doorstep and then City decide to move from the other side of Manchester to our side. So it's even easier for people to go and watch them. And obviously, the prices at City, I don't even think it's that much more expensive to go and watch them than it is to go and watch Oldham. What's pleasing is that, bizarrely, so for me, like as I said, I'm 43, I cling to the good times and I'm grateful to have had those good times. I can't believe that anybody under the age of 35 puts up with that. Because there is literally no hope. But I don't know how, but there is a large volume of that support, a large proportion of that support that is very young, young lads, young girls that come in and do create a great atmosphere. Max, again, I sound like I'm biased. There is so much potential. The bar has been set so low for so long. The town itself is, yeah, it's a working class town. There are nice areas, but it's predominantly a working class town. Population is 250,000. There's a huge Asian community there that, you know, a lot of the Asian kids are football mad. It's never been tapped into. You know, we saw with the faintest glimmer of hope with Sheridan coming back and we're getting more than 6,000 home fans through the turnstiles in League Two. I refuse to believe that that is not a viable League Two and probably League One club. So for me, it should be attractive. But the only hope, and this again sounds really bleak and dark, is that the previous owner who owns the stadium and the land is owed a lot of rent. I think 400 grand has been reported in the local paper. If he puts the club into administration, then that may get rid of the stupid asking price and make it attractive for someone to come in.
I've got to read a statement from the board of directors, which was made a couple of days ago, saying the Oldham Athletic Board of Directors is devastated at the club's relegation. The issues that have led to this point go back years, but the buck stops with the board. Relegation represents a total failure. The plan from next season starts now. The objective is clear: promotion and a return to the EFL. Our budget will be unchanged due to EFL parachute payments. We want to start preparations now. Key to that is keeping the manager. John Sheridan did the best he could in a short amount of time with backing and preparation. We think he will get this club promoted back to the EFL, which is where it belongs. In the following days, we'll meet John to agree a new contract with him. The club's owner remains committed to selling the club. There is a clear process in place for the interested parties. Each bidder has been asked to sign an NDA and provide proof of funds. Conversations with those qualified bidders are ongoing and will continue. While appreciating the huge upset and disappointment to fans, we urged everyone to continue to support the club in these difficult times. The board and staff are committed to working hard to restore our rightful position in league football. I get the sense, Mike, you have less hope than the board of directors.
Yeah, they just can't help themselves. Hot on the heels. That was the first we'd heard from them since the relegation. And then there was another statement after that saying, we will identify the fans who went on the pitch and ban them for life. And the obvious response to that is hundreds of Oldham fans basically tweeting that, I was on the pitch, please ban me. The stuff about the budget, out from what I'm told, the budget was the second lowest in the league last season. You go into the National League, we know the clubs that are down there with serious backing. You know, if they don't come up, the Wrexhams, the Stockports, obviously they'll go, but the Notts Counties, other teams like that. The budget we had this year, the kind of putting it forward as some kind of achievement, it's nowhere near enough. So I think there is a theory that these people look at the upsurge under Sheridan and they think all they need to do is keep John Sheridan in charge and everything will be fine. We are way beyond that point. And while the fans love John Sheridan, there was a poll recently, and I think more than half of the people said they didn't want John Sheridan to carry on under this ownership. So we've got to brace ourselves, Max. There's going to be a lot more pain before it gets better.
Thanks so much for your time, Mike. Appreciate it.
Cheers, guys.
Mike Keegan there from the Daily Mail, and his book is called This Is How It Feels, An English Football Miracle. Just time for a little bit of AOB. Reed said in his latest Guardian article, Barry seems to suggest he can boil an egg in 4 minutes and 39 seconds. What sort of witchcraft is it, and can he share his secret?
Boil an egg in 4 minutes, 39 seconds. I mean, I could probably do, if I was in a mad rush, I could probably do one in 3.5 minutes and it'd be fine, but I don't understand the question.
I suppose the question is how happy are you with like albumin? Like if the white isn't totally all cooked, are you okay with that? You don't mind a bit of a gloop next to the yolk?
But the white will be all cooked in 4.5 minutes.
Okay. Fred says, with cooking oil prices rocketing, which butter does Langdon recommend to close the greasy joy gap, and why is it Kerrygold?
Yeah, I mean, why they did. Kerrygold is definitely a solid one. Just getting back to the eggs there, though, I think one way of doing it, just go poached. I mean, I think I'm in the top 1% of poached egg cookers in the world. Actually, I get it, and now every
big
single
shout.
Time. So,
how many? So give us a like broadly, how many are you doing a week?
4 or 5 poached eggs a week.
So okay, from the moment of, do you do it in a saucepan of hot water?
Yeah, saucepan in hot water.
Use a spoonful of vinegar?
Yes, you
and
do.
And do you create a vortex into which to drop the egg?
Absolutely, Barry.
A snodgrass vortex.
And
yes.
When you drop the egg in, how long do you leave it?
Well, I would leave it sort of 2 minutes 20. That's usually enough. I mean, it could go up to 2:30. I think you've got to have you've got to look at it. But between 2 minutes,
you've got a window.
Between 2:20 and 2:30, yeah. Barry, I would say.
And
how many are you? Yes, sorry. I want to sort of like Dragon's Den. I really want to nail down on the numbers. What? How many are you doing? What's your annual egg poaching number?
Well, I mean, I would probably do like I'd probably have that twice a week, and I'd have I had three right. The other day, two yesterday. So yeah, I mean, I suppose 5 a week.
5 a week.
You see, Max, I think Mark, I think you're a little confused here. Mark is talking about quality of poached eggs, where you're focusing more on quantity.
Yeah. Right. Oh, so you think you're one of the best? You think you're one of the world's best egg poachers? Not necessarily.
Sorry. Yeah, no,
years.
No. Sorry.
Seems
no,
a
I
lot, but not like.
Yeah, I'm not. Not in terms of intake, just in terms of quality. Yeah, I'm quality over quantity.
Right. Okay. Good. You know, just occasionally meat with a side of eggs.
Well, that's steak and we eggs want. Is anyway. The standard dish.
That's classic. Yeah. It is. Anyway, that is all we've got time for today. Lars, it looked like you'd sort of switched off by the end, but, you know, hopefully the listeners hadn't.
I haven't said anything in a very long time, Max, but that's okay. No, I've been slight. I feel like I should start. I've been frying eggs. Maybe I should try to start poaching. I'm not an egg poacher.
No,
I feel like
A fried egg is a classic.
I'm going to start. I'm going to do a poach tomorrow morning, see how it goes.
Well, I'm about to have scrambled eggs and smoked salmon. But because you know it's Thursday, why not?
Yeah, live a little, yeah. Barry.
Well, I have the rest of the day off, so I thought, yeah, I might treat myself. So, but now I'm tempted to try the 2-minute 20 poaching. But I had poached eggs yesterday.
Well, all these dilemmas, we'll find out. We won't find out tomorrow because you're not doing tomorrow's pod because you don't care about your affiliate in the conference league. So hopefully we'll have a panel of people who do.
I really care, then, but I'm not on.
You're not on. No. Bad luck, Lars. We have so many amazing panelists. So, look, you know, you've had a good day today. Thanks, Lars. Appreciate your time.
Anytime, Max.
The Racing Post, Mark Langdon. Thank you.
Thank you, Max.
As producer Joel just wrote, just getting back to the eggs there. It's a very good line from Mark. just getting back to the eggs. Barry, thank you, mate.
You're welcome.
We'll be back tomorrow. Football Weekly was produced by Joel Grove. Our executive producer is Max Sarnas.
This is The Guardian.